You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
My first guest today, who'll be talking about dark matter and related things, was held up in traffic, so he'll be a few moments late, perhaps held up by dark matter. So I thought that I would alert you to some of the interesting things that we'll be talking about over the next week. Tomorrow, Canadian Ambassador Ken Taylor will be talking about working with the United States secretly in 1981 to free the hostages in Iran. His work is now only being declassified, and he describes what pre-revolutionary Iran was like. Then also Siobhan Fallon and Lily Barana describe the challenges of being military wives, from our preconceptions of military wives to coping with the stress of war and distance. The great pianist Byron Janis will describe his long career in music, his physical struggles, and why the music of Chopin is so important to him. And on Underreported, we will look at sexual violence on Sioux reservations and how tribal law can make investigating those crimes more difficult. Also on Backstory, we will look at the Duvaliers. Baby Doc has returned to Haiti, so we will look at what happened in the old days when Baby Doc and his father, Papa Doc, ruled the country. And that's what we'll be doing tomorrow. And Richard Panik is here now. Although humans have always gazed into the night sky in wonder, we're only beginning to realize that the majority of what's out there, all of those twinkling planets and stars, make up about 4% of the known universe. The rest is dark, unseeable, and potentially unknowable. At the moment, theorists think that most of the universe consists of two other things, 23% of something that's being called dark matter, and 73% something even more mysterious called dark energy. Joining us now is Richard Panik, author of The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and the Race to Discover the Rest of the Reality. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you.
So when we say that we only know what makes up 4% of the universe, are we talking about matter, the atoms that make up this microphone I'm talking into, you, me, the Kuiper belt, the moon, the billions of stars that we see across the universe?
That's right. The matter that we've always thought of as being in the universe.
And that's only 4%.
That's only 4%.
Now, people must have thought that was everything for a long time, and then there was just space between them.
Right.
Vacuum.
Right, right. But it turns out that there seems to be this other missing component that takes up 96% of the universe. But yes, for the until the late 1990s, the early 2000s, we thought that everything that we'd always been seeing is only the small fraction.
So why hadn't we been aware that there was this other 96%? Were we forced to come up with some kind of explanation of because certain things were happening that we hadn't understood in the past or even known about in the past?
That's true, yes. In the 1970s, astronomers began to observe that galaxies were rotating too quickly for their own good, that they would be shredding, according to the laws of Newton, they would be shredding matter and gas in all directions. Same thing is true of clusters of galaxies. But if you intuit that there is this other hidden mass out there, then the rotations begin to make sense. I mean, it's either that or you abandon Newton and Einstein.
So you just have to come up with some kind of a theory to explain what's been unexplained. It isn't necessarily the correct theory, is it?
No, it's not necessarily the correct theory. But according to the laws of particle physics, which, you know, the standard model of particle physics is incomplete. We know that. But in the 70s, people began to notice that if certain missing particles, hypothetical particles, if they had the right mass, they would probably be existing in the right quantity to make up all that missing mass. So the argument suddenly became much more compelling. Over the years, I explain this in the book, but over the years, there has been more evidence in favor of this interpretation.
And we call it dark matter because we can't see it.
Right.
Is it possible that it's passing through our bodies as we speak?
If it is one of these two leading hypothetical particles, one is called the neutralino, the other is called the axion, yes, it would be passing through our bodies at the rate of trillions per cubic centimeter.
So that's what dark matter is?
Well, until they find it, they can't be sure. So they're looking for it in particle detectors.
Well, the Hadron Collider was supposed to aid us in this subatomic particle search.
Right.
Has it turned up anything so far?
Not yet, but I don't think it's quite operating at the level that it would need to be in order to spit out a neutralino, let's say.
So we've just come up with these names, the axion and the neutralino.
Right.
But this is nothing new. We've done this sort of thing in the past. We've named things subatomic particles. In fact, Murray Gell-Mann named things that later turned up, but he was just naming that. He was just saying, well, it's likely that we have something like this because of what's happening in nature.
Exactly. Yes. A lot of science is inference. And yeah, I mean, when you think about it, gravity is an inference. We don't know what it is. We just know that it works, and we can measure it, and we can come up with the equations, but we still can't explain what it is.
So how do we think, at this moment anyway, dark matter interacts with regular matter?
Well, that's the problem. It doesn't. I mean, it interacts in terms of its gravitational force, but it doesn't interact in such a way that we can see it through any of the usual methods, which would be through our eyes or any other part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
So the reason we're hypothesizing this is because there is all this gravitational force and no explanation for it.
Right.
And what is the gravitational force doing?
Well, it would seem to be holding together the galaxies in ways that we can't otherwise understand.
Like the Milky Way, which is a spiral galaxy.
Right.
And you would think that by now, after billions and billions of years, it would have spun off a bit. Also remains relatively flat.
It does. And in fact, if in the early 1970s, I was talking about the observational evidence before, but there's also computer simulations that they could run on the Milky Way that shows, and these have held up, of course, over the years, but that show that the Milky Way has probably rotated about, I don't remember the number now, maybe 12 times, 15 times, something like that in the course of its existence. But if there weren't dark matter there, it would have destabilized and flung apart in its first rotation.
It would have spun out of control.
Right.
Now, most of the galaxies are spiral galaxies, but not all of them.
Right.
Is there something special about being a spiral galaxy?
I'm not a scientist. I write about science, so there are differences between spiral galaxies and elliptical galaxies, but I can't speak to how they differ in terms of dark matter.
Are galaxies evenly distributed in the universe?
On a large scale, yes. Locally, we have a local group, which is, a dozen galaxies. The Andromeda Galaxy is one. But if you step back and look at the universe over a large enough area, then yes, the distribution is more or less uniform.
So if the Hadron Collider actually does do what we hope it will do, what will we get out of it? Is it just a matter of seeing these two aspects of dark matter?
Right. But these things always lead, the new discoveries like this always lead in directions that you can't really imagine in advance. So if they discover this particle, I mean, what happens if they discover one of these particles and it turns out not to exist in the right quantity? There's nothing that says that this missing matter, this dark matter, has to be all one thing. I mean, what if it turns out to be a whole cocktail of things?
So it may not just be the axion and the neutralino. These are just convenient things that we've come up with.
Right.
And what about, well, first of all, let me tell my audience, my guest is Richard Panik, P-A-N-E-K. His latest book, The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and The Race to Discover the Rest of Reality. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Now we come to dark energy.
Right.
So if it wasn't confusing enough, this dark matter, which makes up how much of the universe by current theory?
It makes up about 80% of the matter in the universe, but if you add mass and energy, which Einstein tells us are equivalent, then dark matter is about 23% of the universe.
And then dark energy, the other rest of this 96% is dark energy?
Right, that would be 73%.
And what is dark energy? What kinds of properties do we think it exhibits?
In the 1990s, there were two teams of astronomers who were trying to figure out how much mass was in the universe. They knew that there was all this dark matter now, but they were wondering, is there enough mass that the expansion of the universe will eventually slow down through gravitational interaction and contract and kind of go into a reverse Big Bang, or will it just expand forever and even out?
Because from what we know, just from our own experience, if there's a Big Bang, if there's an explosion, things fly from it.
Right.
But as they get further and further away from the center, they slow down.
Right.
And these guys discovered that was not happening?
Well, they expected to find out that it was either slowing down enough that there would be a kind of reverse Big Bang, or it was slowing down just enough that it would kind of peter out forever and just kind of even out. What they found instead, though, is that that the expansion is speeding up. It's accelerating.
That goes against everything that I can imagine.
Well, that's right.
That's almost as tough to imagine as infinity.
Right. Right. As the universe expands then and it's speeding up, there must be some force of some sort that is more powerful than gravity on a cosmic scale. And so, again, kind of punting, if you will, they said, all right, we'll call this, if we call the other thing dark matter, we'll call this dark energy.
In an article you wrote for the New York Times some years back, you quote David Schlegel of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory as saying that dark energy might not be dark. It might not be energy. The whole name is a placeholder for the description that there's something funny that we don't understand.
Right. But we can see through numerous experiments, especially over the last 10 years, that the universe wouldn't look the way it does, as that we can see in the cosmic microwave background. The universe doesn't look the way that it does if there weren't this component of dark matter and this component of dark energy, regardless of what they are. They're there, and they seem to be establishing the universe that we can see.
Are there any theories as to where they come from? Are they just part of the what came out of the Big Bang?
Right, exactly. It would have been – dark energy would have been there from the beginning. Right now what they're trying to figure out – you know, in dark matter we were saying that they're trying to figure out, is it the neutralino? Is it the axion? In dark energy, they're not trying to figure out what it is so much as how it behaves.
Tom, one of our listeners, Tom in Santa Clara, left a comment on our show page asking, how do we know this dark matter stuff is not just a cop-out like phlogiston?
Well, that question comes
phlogiston.
Up. Phlogiston. That question comes up a lot. But, you know, I hope you'll read the book. But there, I explain in there that there are these experiments. For instance, I was just talking about the cosmic microwave background, that these extraordinarily precise measurements have been done of it that show that the universe, you know, you can run computer simulations of a million universes, 10 million universes, and the only one that matches is the one that has this component of dark matter and dark energy. So astronomers are, you know, they're as confident as they can be at this point. Of course, science, nature always surprises us, but for now, this is the best system we've got.
When we talk about dark energy and dark matter, it conjures up images of black holes. Are they related?
No, completely different. This is not dark as in black holes or dark as in deep space. This is dark as in unseeable and possibly unknowable, which is humbling in itself.
Well, we've engaged in some kind of a give and take over the years, and Einstein plays a key role in both the in all the aspects of it. What did he do?
Well, Einstein's original calculations, his original equations for general relativity, when he tried to apply them on a universal scale, he realized that to keep the universe stable, which is the universe he knew, one that was only one galaxy big and everything rotated, you know, very uniformly and predictably, in order to keep that stable, he had to insert a fudge factor that he called lambda, totally arbitrarily.
The cosmological constant.
Right. And he wasn't satisfied with that. But then a few years later, when it turned out the universe was expanding, it turns out that he didn't need this fudge factor, that he could take it out. And in fact, it still accounted for the expansion. Then it would account for the expansion of the universe. However, now it was in the equation. And the equation makes sense with it in there, even if you set it to zero, lambda. Even if you say lambda doesn't exist.
But he called lambda his biggest mistake.
That's right. Yeah, supposedly that's the legend. He called it his greatest blunder.
And now it's been suggested that if he were still alive, he would have won a Nobel Prize itself.
Right. Yes, definitely. And in fact, the people who are in the book are, you know, there are future Nobelists in there for sure.
So what happened? The lambda was taken out.
Right.
And then people were forced to say, wait a minute, Einstein may have been right, even though he thought he was wrong.
Right. Yes, it gets a little twisty. But if you set lambda to zero, you can have an expanding universe. If you have an accelerating expansion of the universe, which is what they discovered in 1968, then lambda no longer equals zero. And then lambda, the cosmological constant, comes back into play.
My guest is Richard Panik. His latest book, The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and the Race to Discover the Rest of Reality, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Richard Panik, P-A-N-E-K, whose previous books include Seeing and Believing and The Invisible Century. His most recent, The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and the Race to Discover the Rest of Reality, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We talked earlier about what happened in 1998. All of this is fairly recent.
Oh, very recent.
When these two rival teams of astronomers announced that the universe was expanding.
That's right. Well, no, they didn't announce that it was expanding. They said that the expansion was speeding up.
Accelerating.
Right. It's accelerating. Correct.
How did they measure that?
They used something called type 1A supernovae, which are exploding stars that are visible at great distances across the universe, halfway back to the Big Bang, more than that. And by measuring them, they could by measuring their brightness and their against their distances, they could see that at a certain point in the history of the universe, they were becoming dimmer than they would be if the universe were expanding uniformly at a uniform rate. They expected to see them get brighter after a certain distance, which would mean that they were nearer, which means that the expansion is slowing down. And instead, they found the opposite.
So does the expansion mean that in time we won't be able to see the galaxies at the edge of the universe, or even if we wait long enough, the ones closest to us?
The ones closest to us in the local group, we think that gravity, local gravity, will outweigh the dark energy. But yes, dark energy, if it turns out to be the cosmological constant, which means that it's uniform over space and time, the acceleration will just keep on accelerating. And at a certain point, when we're talking about the acceleration, we're talking about space accelerating, and space can go faster than the speed of light. Okay.
The only thing that can go faster than the speed of light.
As far as we know, yes. So the space expanding would go faster than the speed of light, which means that it would disappear from our view.
But what happens if the universe keeps expanding forever? What happens to matter? What happens to time?
Well, I guess it still applies on a local level for us and the galaxies that we can see. But I was talking to an astronomer who's doing dark energy research, and he said that if he's right, if their research is right, and it certainly appears to be very strongly, then about 100 billion years from now, he said his profession will be dead, cosmology.
We have a little clip that is relevant to this. Let's listen to it.
He's been depressed. All of a sudden, he can't do anything.
Why are you depressed, Alvy?
Tell Dr. Flicker. It's something he read.
Something you read, huh?
The universe is expanding.
The universe is expanding?
Well, the universe is everything. And if it's expanding, someday it will break apart and that will be the end of everything.
What is that your business? He stopped doing his homework.
What's the point?
What has the universe got to do with it? You're here in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is not expanding.
It won't be expanding for billions of years yet, Alvy. We've got to try and enjoy ourselves while we're here, huh?
That was from Woody Allen's Annie Hall, made before we discovered that it was accelerating. Who knows what Alvy would have said if he'd known it was accelerating.
Whatever it was, it would have been funny.
But I'm sure that physicists and astronomers who are doing this work actually worry about these things.
Well, they do. You mean the universe expanding and falling? Yes, yes.
And falling apart.
Yeah. They do. If dark energy is not the cosmological constant, if it varies over space and time, they don't think it does. But if it does, they haven't ruled that out. Then all bets are off. We don't know what the future holds.
Of course, Alvy was consoled by the fact that it won't happen for billions of years, so we won't be around to notice.
No, unfortunately. Wouldn't you love to?
No, I'm be happy not to see everything fall apart. It's falling apart enough right now. The two cornerstones of 20th century physics were general relativity, mm-hmm. Einstein's theory, how very large objects operate, in quantum mechanics, and then Bohr and the others, how very small objects operate. But the two are incompatible, and string theory is one of the ideas that have been proposed to reconcile the two. Does string theory work within all of this?
You know, it might. String theory has been around for 30 years now or so, and they haven't been able to figure out a way yet to validate it or to make all the equations work. If it does work out and there are all these hidden dimensions, then who knows? You know, maybe it will explain some of these mysteries that we're encountering. As I said earlier, gravity is this unknown, and it's possible that gravity is leaking in from a parallel universe. So we don't, you know, it's fun to speculate.
Andrew, one of our listeners, asks, isn't our not being able to sense dark matter akin to fish swimming in the ocean? Fish don't see the water or sense that it's something to differentiate. It's just like space to us, no?
That's a really good analogy, I think, that we've spent our whole time in civilization looking at the other fish around us and looking at the ocean floor and mapping the ocean floor and saying, boy, this is really great. And then somebody comes along and says, yes, but there's water.
My guest is Richard Panik. His book, The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and the Race to Discover the Rest of Reality, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is also WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Carl Sagan used to say that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. We have a sense that dark matter and dark energy must be there, but they haven't been discovered yet. So where are we really?
Well, we're at the point where the astronomers are operating at a very high confidence level based on a confluence of observations that all seem to be reinforcing one another. I mean, look, they all know Carl Sagan's saying, and they all, including the people who made these discoveries, wanted to disprove it. And they couldn't knock it down. In fact, all they could do was make it stronger and stronger, to their surprise.
If we've only been looking at 4% of the universe, can we argue that we haven't been looking at the universe at all?
Exactly. And that's kind of amazing. Well, part of my motivation in writing this book is that, you know, at first you hear about these things and you don't believe them, and then or you think it's hyperbolic. But then the more I did research on it, I thought, oh, this is really valid. And at a certain point, you go, well, if this is true, then we're on the cusp of something extraordinary. And I thought it would be great to capture that moment where we're on the cusp. And in the future, maybe this will all look like a great turning point in civilization.
Although, as we've seen with string theory, there's been a lot of controversy within the people who are working on string theory. And, of course, there are many who just dismiss it. Some very good physicists say that they think it's a lot of time and energy devoted to something that is just a pipe dream. What about this? Has there been a lot of controversy within the scientific community?
Well, let's not leave string theory just for a moment. I don't know if you're aware, but tonight at the Rubin Museum, I'm doing a conversation with Lee Smolin, who is one of the physicists. He had a best-selling book. And
he's been here to talk about string theory.
Oh, has he? Okay, great. Yes, and he's
I know something about string theory.
And he's
not much, but Lee Smolin really knows a lot.
Yeah, and he's one of the people who's been saying maybe string theory is getting physics off track.
Yeah.
So that's possible. But the difference between string theory and dark matter and dark energy is that string theory is purely theoretical. They have the math and they're trying to figure it out, whereas dark matter and dark energy are observation-based. They're based on solid observations that have been repeated again and again.
But still, one of the stories explored in your book is the amount of academic infighting and bitterness surrounding all of this new science.
Mm-hmm.
Why? If everybody agrees that it's there, then what's the problem?
Well, the problem is priority and history. And as it's become clear that this is a truly momentous discovery, the two members of the two teams often bicker about who deserves more credit for doing what first. It gets messy.
When you say a momentous discovery, you call what's happening in science right now the ultimate Copernican revolution. So can we compare it to Copernicus?
I think so. I think that Copernicus came up with the math that shows the sun at the center, and Galileo came along and found this, found all these observations that validated that interpretation. In the same way that Einstein and quantum theory have made certain predictions, like the expansion of the universe, the accelerating expansion of the universe, and now we have these new Galileos, is what I actually like to think of them as, who are validating that.
Although all of the people in the past were doing it on very little budgets. Einstein probably, it cost him the cost of paper and ink.
Right.
We're talking now about people fighting over millions of dollars in grant money, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And right now there's a huge controversy going on about a space mission that would cost something like $1.5, $1.6 billion. And it's been approved, but it's getting all tied up in bureaucracy and budget issues and everything. But, yeah, I mean, dark energy has pushed astronomy maybe more than anything into the era of big science.
Where are people doing all of this research?
Oh, well, I went down to the South Pole, which was great.
Why the South Pole?
Because the atmosphere there is very stable and very dry, which means that the images, that the microwave images, it's especially sensitive to microwave, the microwave background, and the seeing there, as astronomers call it, during the dark months, 6 to 8 months of darkness, is just unprecedented. I mean, you have to go into space to get something better.
And we are in space in the Hubble, but it's hard to get time on the Hubble.
Right.
Are these scientists having to fight for their share of time?
Oh, of course, yes. There's always you always have to make proposals. But they now have a good enough track record that they can get time on Hubble pretty much when they – I don't know. I shouldn't say pretty much when they want to, but they have a high greater likelihood.
So on the one hand, they're on the South Pole. The other hand, they're underground in Switzerland.
Right, at the Large Hadron Collider.
And then the Hubble.
Right.
What have we learned from the Hubble so far? We still can't see the dark matter or the dark energy.
No, but there was a very interesting experiment. Well, I guess it wasn't an experiment, an observation that Adam Riess at Johns Hopkins University, although at the time he might have been with the Space Telescope Science Institute, but he realized that you could go back. We talked about supernovae earlier, that if you went back to some Hubble observations, you might be able to compare supernovae over a period of time. And so he went into the archives and he found them. And that was really a very compelling piece of evidence that convinced a lot of the community to take dark energy seriously. And this was in 2001. And I was actually present at the conference where he presented this information. And it was stunning. I mean, you know, these people who have been around for decades were gasping.
Is NASA playing a role in all of this?
Well, NASA's playing a role if there were to be this dark energy satellite. And they're playing a role in that.
Well, they've had budget cutbacks.
Well, they've had budget cutbacks, and that's a huge problem. And they have now the last major space telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope, is way over budget and way late. And that's pushing everything back in the pipeline, including any dark energy research on that kind of billion-dollar level.
Well, right now, we talk a lot about energy and the problems of finding alternatives to the kind of energy sources that we use.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that anybody would imagine we could harness dark energy, is there?
Not that I can imagine, but if you go back to Einstein in 1905 saying we can treat light as a photon rather than just as a wave, that's the beginning of quantum theory. And, of course, quantum theory now is, you know, it's running computers and it's doing all sorts of things. It's changed our lives.
How would a dark energy satellite look for these substances?
It would use various methods. One would be the supernovae that we talked about, these exploding stars from halfway across the universe. Other observations would be showing how the distribution of galaxies, you know, as you look into the night sky, you're looking farther and farther back in time. So you can look back and see how the distribution of galaxies has changed over time, which would be influenced by dark energy.
Didn't you set out to be a writer of fiction?
Yes, I went
to. This stuff seems a lot more fictional than fiction.
Well, I have two writing degrees, one in journalism, one in fiction. And what I found is that in writing about science, you have these great narratives, and you can do all the research of journalism, and then you can take the narrative techniques of fiction, and without fictionalizing anything, create this story. And I hope I did.
I've one of the things I always wonder about is how Einstein would view all of this.
Well,
I think he'd be both proud and totally confounded.
I think he would be proud. He would feel vindicated in many ways, and I don't know about confounded. In my experience of doing research on Einstein, it's never been I don't know that he's been confounded so much as just greatly intrigued and interested, eager.
Well, quantum mechanics also suggests alternate universes.
Yes.
Are we assuming that those alternate universes would also have dark matter and dark energy? Or anti-dark matter and anti-dark energy?
Well, according to quantum theory, the universe very easily could, I should say very easily, but it could have arisen out of a quantum fluctuation, a pop of an antiparticle or particle into existence, and that's brings us, if that's the case, and again, there is accumulating evidence for this, then there were probably something like 10 to the 500 other universes, some of which would have some properties and others, and ours just happens to be the one that has 4% regular matter and 96% unknown.
Do scientists have a sense of how long it's going to take to actually come up with something more specific?
Well, they're always hoping, they're always saying that dark matter will be discovered within the next 5 years. And they've been saying this since the 1970s. And in fact, Vera Rubin, who is one of the discoverers of the evidence for dark matter, has said she stopped making those predictions because she just makes fun of them now. So, you know, at any point, it could pop out of a detector. So that's what they're hoping for. Dark energy, no. I mean, that's dark energy, you mentioned quantum mechanics, is probably going to take a reconciliation of general relativity and quantum mechanics in order to make sense of dark energy. And, you know, it could happen tomorrow. Some Einstein or Newton is working it out today and about to post it on the internet, or it could take the rest of our lifetimes.
For somebody to come up with this theory of everything.
Yeah.
Richard Panik's book, The 4% Universe, Dark Matter, Dark Energy, and the Race to Discover the Rest of Reality, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a delight. Thank you.